God, we thank you for today. We thank you for the opportunity just to fellowship, to worship. God, this is a special day as we even recall when you entered into Jerusalem. And God, quite a scene. And so God, as we process you coming in as king and laying down your life, God, may that just continue to resonate with us in the entire week to come. God, we anticipate what that looked like. You presenting yourself as the perfect sacrifice and dying in our stead. And then God raised you up, Jesus, to the highest place, gave you the name that is above every name, and that is the reason. It's because of that great hope of the resurrection that we celebrate and that we even join on a Sunday morning, God. That's why we're here this morning, is in part to commemorate the first day of the week that you rose from the dead. And God, may that ever be on the front of our mind. In your name, amen. I wish I could bring you an igneous or a sedimentary rock and then put some extreme heat, fire, and pressure on that. Because if you add extreme heat and pressure to an igneous or a sedimentary rock, what happens? It turns into something entirely different. It's no longer an igneous or sedimentary rock. It's a metamorphic rock. And so what happens if we were able to take a microscope and really look at what is happening, which we wouldn't be able to do because it's so intense and so hot, but we would see that the very elements themselves move and change, and they transform. What they were once figuring, they are now a whole different figure. They were transfigured. And if we could look at a microscope, we would say it's so different. It's so different. It's not just rocks rubbing against each other. But I can't do that to show you that metamorphic change. And that's kind of the definition of transformation, is such a change that even the DNA itself kind of changes. It transforms. So there is an illustration I can share with you. Many of you have seen it before. It's the idea of a butterfly, right? And when you first see the butterfly, it's this little creepy caterpillar, right? And the caterpillar gets into a cocoon or a chrysalis, and it turns into a moth or a butterfly. And we were amazed at that maybe as a little kid. We took our youth to Chicago a couple years back, and we had the opportunity to do this urban cleansing in just a few acres that it was once a dump, and we cleaned it all out, and it was a place that the school kids would come to, and we built this butterfly house behind us. And that's what they would do. They'd bring some foliage in there, and these little creepy crawlers would come in there, and they'd eat on the foliage, and then they would turn into a chrysalis or a cocoon, and then they would eventually come out of that as a beautiful butterfly. And some of you have maybe done that with your kids or grandkids before. You've captured them, and if the kids were big enough, they weren't just smushing them or grossed out by them, but they allowed them to eat and turn into that chrysalis and form a butterfly. And we've taken our kids down to St. Paul. There's a place where there's a butterfly house. That's at Como Park. And so I don't know what it is, but they all just like to lay on my belly. I mean, it was like the kids were having a good time. It's like, Dad, they just keep landing on your belly. And there were hundreds, if not thousands, of these butterflies. And to see them go from something that is totally different, it's a metamorphosis. They transform, right? And so that's the word picture I want you to keep in the back of your mind as we kind of skip some stones through some passages this morning. It's this idea of bold transformation. You don't need to turn there, but I want to highlight two stories real quick and then get to maybe the meat of it. And the stories has to do, the first one is Moses. And if you know Moses' story, kind of flannel graphed in your head, that even as a young child, God rescued him. And 40 years later, he realized he himself was a Hebrew, although he was a prince of Egypt. And he killed a man, he murdered a man because of the torture they were doing to the Jews. And he fled to Arabia, became a shepherd there. And then God met him on a mountain, Mount Horeb, and met him in the burning bush and said, you're going to bring your people, my people, back to this place, and I'm going to speak to them there. I'm going to be their God, I'm going to be your God, and they're going to be my people. And so that's exactly what happened, and all the miracles that happened in Egypt and the Exodus and the Red Sea crossing, and he brought them to this mountain, and Moses goes up to the mountain and talks to God and finds this great favor with him. And God is pleased that his name would go forth with him. And there's this common thread that starts to make its way through the scriptures about being in God's presence. about this mutual pleasing of God and God being pleased with us. And Moses pressed it a little farther. He's just, man, if I could just look at you. And God basically said, summarizing here, yeah, you can't handle me. And he put him back into kind of the crevice of the rock, and God walked by and he could see the glory pass by. Moses came down off the mountain and he's sharing this experience, but even before the elders there, they were just kind of like, whoa, Moses, something's different. You're shining. And they were afraid of him. And Moses said, no, come here. And he shared the commandments that God had given him. And they were still kind of afraid of him. And when Moses finished speaking to them, this is chapter 34 of Exodus, he put a veil over his face. But whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with him, he removed the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, they saw that his face was radiant. And then Moses would put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with the Lord. There was a transformation that took place in Moses' life. And it was incremental over his life, but when he was really in the presence of God, it changed. It metamorphed who he was. He was a totally different person that God had changed him just being in his presence. There's another guy by the name of Elijah, and he battled it out. This is in 1 Kings 19. And he battled it out with all the prophets of Baal. James, in the book of James, he reminds us that Elijah wasn't superhuman. He was a man just like us, James says. And he prayed, and God showed up in a tremendous way. And then Elijah left Mount Carmel, and he kind of fled. And you know where he ended up? He ended up in Arabia. And he ended up on the same mountain, Mount Horeb, and he's back in this cave. And God shows up and says, what are you doing here, Elijah? He says, go out to the edge of the cave, and I'm going to show myself. Elijah just kind of stayed hunkered back in the cave. And there's this great windstorm, and there's this great earthquake, and there's this great firestorm, but God was not in the wind. He wasn't in the earthquake. He wasn't in the fire. You know that story. God was in what? Yeah, he was in the gentle whisper. He was in the still, small voice. And you know what it says Elijah did? When he heard the gentle whisper, when Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. And the voice said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And God went on to commission him to go and anoint the king of Aram and the king of Israel. And the next prophet to take his place was Elisha. But there's something about this mutual pleasing God. There's something about being in the presence of God that we can hardly handle it. His glory is so much, his Shekinah glory is so much that we can hardly handle it, and they had to veil their faces. I'm going to leapfrog into the life of Christ now. Those are kind of the backstories. And Jesus had been teaching the masses, and he's been healing and doing miracles, and he would pull aside, as he was accustomed to do, and just spend some time huddling with his disciples. And on this one occasion, as he was getting towards the latter end of his ministry, he asked his disciples, who are the people, who do they think I am? And you recall this story. The people said, well, some think that you're a great prophet, referring kind of to Moses here. Some think that you're Elijah. And then what? Peter steps forward and says, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now that's a great revelation. In fact, Jesus went on to say that this hasn't been revealed to you by man, but by God himself, that I'm the Messiah. But I don't know that Peter really knew what he was saying. I think he was beginning to grasp a little bit of it. That was probably part of his old Jewish teaching that he had forgot, and then Jesus was renewing all of these things. And yet he was beginning to articulate, he was mentally assenting of, okay, you're greater than Elijah, you're greater than Moses, you're greater than the prophets, you must be the Messiah. Because right away, Jesus went to proclaim what the Messiah was going to do. He was going to lay down his life. He was going to die. And Peter's like, no way. As long as I'm here, you're not going to die. And Jesus confronted him right away. Get behind me, deceiver, Satan. Get behind me, because that's not what the Messiah came to do. There wasn't a fullness of the idea of Messiah. Then Peter was missing part of that. And I think that kind of stuck with the disciples. I would think that conversation stuck with them. And we pick up the passage. This is the main passage in Matthew 17. You're welcome to turn there. And Matthew 17 talks about the change, a transformation, a transfiguration, a very elemental change. And now not only has Peter have heard it and have seen Jesus and his miracles, now he's seeing Jesus revealed in all of his glory, and he can't hardly handle it. I just want to walk through this. So a week later, it says after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and they went up onto a high mountain, and Jesus was transfigured before them. It says his face shone like the sun, and his robes were as bright as light. And there standing before them appeared Moses and Elijah talking to Jesus. Eventually, Peter spoke up and said, "Hey, God, it's good for us to be here. And if you wish it, we'll build you some shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And while he is still speaking, this brilliant cloud envelops them, and a voice from the cloud says, "This is my son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Listen to him." And when that voice came, the disciples immediately fell on their face, and they were terrified. Terrified. And Jesus came to them and said, "Don't be afraid. Get up." Disciples lifted up their eyes, and they saw that Jesus was the only one there. And it says, as they came down the mountain, curious conversation. As they came down the mountain, Jesus said to them, "Don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man is raised from the dead." And that's it. Just want to unpack this for a moment. What would that have felt like to be one of the three, to be so special, to be called out from the huddle of disciples, let alone the multitude, and to go up this mountain and to see Jesus transfigured? What would that have been like? His face shone like the sun. I get it. They're looking away because his garments are so bright. What would that have been like to see that happen? And then if that's not enough, Moses and Elijah. Come on, Moses and Elijah show up. Wow. But evidently, they still weren't quite getting it yet because they haven't fell on their face, right? And so while Peter's just kind of fumbling for words and trying to understand the situation, this voice. So if to not be called out specialized enough, to not see Jesus in his glory enough, if Moses and Elijah appearing was not enough, the voice of God was enough. And he said, "This is my beloved son, whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." They were terrified. Terrified and fell on their faces. They were beginning to get it. The glory of this one, the glory of Jesus, far surpassed anything that came before him. He was superior, the book of Hebrews says, than all that came before him. Amazing story. And just why the metamorphosis? Why the change? It was good for them. It was good for them that it wasn't just an idea. I think sometimes we come to Christianity and it's an idea. And maybe we mentally assent. In other words, we acknowledge or we historically gather, okay, this happened historically. And I think Peter was in the midst of being transfigured and transformed himself, of changing himself, but he wasn't fully there getting it yet. But the experience itself being tangible. Why Moses and Elijah? It highlights the story that the law and the prophets, Jesus came to fulfill the law and the prophets, and I think that's a big picture of it. But Luke gives us some insight. I just want to give you this address for later. Luke 9, 28 to 36 gives us this same account. He also adds, this is funny, he also adds that the three of them were sleepy. And he also tells us what they're talking about. Moses and Elijah and Jesus, they're talking about Jesus' soon departure from Jerusalem. Fascinating. Think about that. Think about the departure of Moses. Think about the departure of Elijah. And if you don't know the backstory of Moses even departing from Mount Sinai to go into the wilderness wanderings, it's kind of mind-blowing coming down off the mountain. And eventually he misrepresents God, and God allows him to see the promised land from Mount Nebo, but he dies there. That was his ultimate departure there. Elijah was a little different. He went and anointed the king of Aram. He went and anointed the king of Israel, anointed Elisha. And then God took him in a miraculous way, like this chariot of fire, thunder, it describes it. Departures, thinking about their departures. And that's the conversation they're having with Jesus. Thinking about his departure, bringing an encouraging word to him. Absorbing the glory that beheld them at that moment. Why the voice? There's this echo of pleasure that we see when God's voice shows up, specifically talking about his son. And I think of this in maybe common vernacular of like, "This is my son whom I'm well pleased." It's like God is saying, "I'm proud of you, that you are doing exactly what I asked you to do." Right? And Jesus said another place, "I only do that which the Father has me to do." And this is like the confirmation of that. I am pleased with him. Great glory to be held in that. Listen to him. And then the last question from this is, why remain silent? Remember, he told them coming off the mountain, don't say anything about this until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Because I think this whole thing is pointing to, yes, you must be the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, don't tell anybody about this until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. He's pointing over and over again in their heart of hearing that he must die. There's three significant things, is that he's the Son of Man, that he must raise from the dead. He's the Son of Man, he's going to die, and he's going to raise from the dead. It's just real simple terms there, and that's the focal point of that whole story. Sometimes we get caught up, and maybe rightfully so, in the glory, the transfiguration that's happening to Jesus, but it was all pointing to, this is must what happens first, that he would die and raise from the dead. So I want to give you this, Romans 12, 1 to 2, and you may be familiar with this passage as well. Therefore, I urge you, there's this boldness. I want us to be encouraged by this idea of transformation, that Jesus was transformed, Moses and Elijah, and we're about to see Paul and Peter was transformed in their own life. There's a whole different livelihood to him, and Paul is writing this. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, there's a boldness to that. I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices. Living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. There's that thread again. Of pleasing God, the mutual pleasing of God here. I heard this one from a pastor one time. What makes living sacrifices difficult is that they like to crawl off the altar. That we're to die to ourselves, and yet though living, we represent him, and we are all in on the altar. But the tendency is, if we don't take up our cross daily, is to crawl off the altar. And that's the opposite of pleasing him, right? And don't miss this. I want you to still think metamorphosis, being transfigured, being consumed by the presence of God, that to be changed by. In view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Then it says, don't conform any longer to the patterns of this world. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So he's encouraging us. Don't, because the tendency is to just keep doing what is just natural. Human nature, just to keep conforming to the status quo, just getting along, waking up in the morning, doing my thing, going to work. He said, don't just conform to that, but be reformed by the renewing of your mind. No, it doesn't say reformed, by the way, does it? But we think that. We think that. This is a default of Christianity sometimes as a religion, is that we are to be reformed. In other words, that we are to change our behaviors, that we are about behavior modification. No, no, no. We are not about being better people. We are not about getting our behavior right in order to come into the presence of God. Otherwise, the word reformed may have been used here, but the word is metamorphosis. There has to be an elemental change of who we are. We have to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. And that word renewing is like a constructionist that's renovating. It's totally different when they're done renovating. By the renovation of our mind, there's got to be a metamorphosis. Phil cannot be reformed enough. I cannot be good enough to do it. You got to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to prove what is good and pleasing in the perfect will of God. There's got to be a transformation, or it's all for naught. And we're just putting on a show if it's about reforming, if it's just about getting our behavior in line. It's not. It's not about that. That stuff comes by being transformed. By the renewing of our mind, be transformed, metamorphed. I'm thinking of Paul and Peter. So two examples here. Paul was of that mind of being reformed. In his own eyes and in the eyes of the Pharisees, he was a good guy. But he said, all of that is for naught. My righteousness is not anything compared to his righteousness. And when he was transformed, he became a different person altogether. By the way, he saw the glory of Jesus. It blinded him. God healed him, and he went on to evangelize to the Gentiles. But do you know, Galatians tells us that he took 3 years to get this thing figured out. In the book of Galatians, it says he went to Arabia. That's a fascinating thought. That's all it says. But Phil's mind wonders, oh my goodness, I wonder if he pilgrimaged to Mount Horeb. Now that would be a cool story. Guess what? That story's not in the Bible. But it says he went to Arabia for 3 years, and he came back and he was emboldened. He was an emboldened disciple. He was a bold, transformed being. So much so that when people looked at him, that sometimes they thought he was a god. Yeah. Yeah, he and Barnabas went on some of their journeys, and he was doing some miracles, healing people, even got bit by a snake once, and people looked at him as if he was otherworldly. And once they even called them Zeus and Hermes. Did you see that perspective? They look on them that they were totally transformed as if they were something else. To the book of Acts. Peter, likewise, he was still gaining traction on the transformation that was happening in his own life. And when Jesus was raised from the dead, and he saw, oh my goodness, this is what he was talking about all along. It's a greater hope. It's not just a reforming of the Romans getting thrown over. It's a transformation from the inside out. It's not just a sanitizing of what's on the outside, but it's a totally changed DNA, spiritually speaking. And Peter got it. He got it. Acts 5:15, there's this curious passage as a result of the transformation in Peter's life. People were bringing their sick into the streets and laid them on beds and mats so that at least Peter's shadow might fall on them as he passed by. Many who were sick or tormented by spirits, all of them were healed. That is a metamorphosis of his life. And Peter would be the first to tell you that it's not I, it's Jesus in me. It's the identity of Christ in me that has changed this, that has tweaked this. And I love it. It kind of comes full circle. With Peter, he recounts the transformation, the change. 2 Peter 1:16, he's finally able to say what he saw on this mountain. We did not follow, 2 Peter 1:16, we did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, for he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice, I love how he points to this, he doesn't say anything about Elijah and Moses. He's talking about the voice here. When the voice came from him, from the majestic glory, his majesty, saying, "This is my son, whom I love, with him I'm well pleased." We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain. That will change your life. Hearing that, being so tangible, walking with Jesus, and then realizing, oh man, this is far greater than any human story that's taking place. Bold transformation. Who was I? Have I changed? Is there something different about me compared to who I used to be? Who was I? Who am I? Do I realize that I am the unveiled aroma of Christ and the echo of pleasing him? Well done is my calling, just as it was Paul, just as it was Peter. We are called to that transformed life. It said so in Romans. That word transformation is the same word when Jesus was transfigured. It's metamorpho. And we are called to that same transformation. Who are you? Are you waiting on the approval of man or of God? There's a passage in 2 Corinthians. We've been in this before. This is worth turning to, just to kind of be unsettled a little bit as we wrap up here. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Aaron shared from chapter 4 a few weeks back. And this is the visual that he gives us. We're talking about a bold transformation. At a very elemental level. Verse 12 of chapter 3 of 2 Corinthians. Therefore, since we have such a hope, we have a tremendous hope. We're celebrating that even through Palm Sunday and Easter next week. And it's not only that Jesus died. I've said this before. I wish we had more than just a cross to wear around our neck. We should all have little tombstones around our neck, right? Because it's not just about the death of Jesus. It's about his resurrection and a great hope that he's talking about here. We have such a hope. We are very bold, it says. It says it right there. We're not like Moses who put a veil over his face to keep the Israelites from gazing at it while the radiance was fading away. But their minds were made dull, for to this day the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. It has not been removed because only in Christ is it taken away. You can be listening to this message today, tomorrow, and you won't get it unless the miracle of the veil is pulled back for you to know that God is so real and he's made himself tangible through his son, Jesus Christ. And that glory that's shown through him is available to us, that we are to be transformed, transfigured, metamorphed in the same way, in the same likeness, because it's only in Christ that this veil is taken away. Even to this day, verse 15, when Moses is read, a veil covers their hearts. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And catch this, this is a key verse. This is a good verse to internalize, to memorize, to put inside of you. And we who with unveiled faces, we're called to this, to unveil. We with unveiled faces, all reflect the Lord's glory, we are being metamorphed. We are being transfigured. We are being changed. We are transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory. And there's a glory when we measure. I think about the caterpillar. There's a little glory there, not much, spiky little critters, right? And then they cocoon, and there's a glory there, but it's an anticipation of what is to come, and they start to break forth, and you don't want to hurry that along, because then they won't be able to fly. So there's a piece to this that is so miraculous all the way from stage to stage, from ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. We're called to that transformation in our own lives. It's like this to me. I remember being in a dorm, and I was typing away. But I remember typing away, and I was so intense on what I was doing. And I was going through Hebrews 12, and Hebrews 12 kind of wraps it up. 11 talked about all these great men and women of the faith, and it says, therefore, since we have this great cloud of witnesses, we throw off everything that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles us, and that we should fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. And I had a roommate sitting there, and I was telling him, I was like, did you know this was in here? Have you read this before? And I had a furrowed brow and just as intense as I was typing away. And I said, what does it say? He said, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorned its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And he looked at me and said, say that again. And just intently, I'm like, partly mad because I'm like, didn't you hear what I said? It's like, we're to fix our eyes on Jesus, who's the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorned its shame, sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And we shouldn't grow weary and lose heart. And he goes, I thought that's what you said. You should tell your face that. Because I had mentally assented. I understood what was going on, but I hadn't been transfigured. And it took me a week or so, and I'm like, oh my goodness. It was for the joy that was set before him that he left the throne and came down here to die for me. When I discovered that motivation, it's like, oh my goodness. No greater joy. Do you get it? Do you see that transformation? It's so different than just acknowledging that Jesus came, historically he died, rose from the dead. That there has to be a transformation of our heart. It has to engage us there. It has to be like, then we can be all in. Then God can transform the outside. He can sanitize that afterwards. That's not what it was about. Jesus coming as Messiah was to transfigure our hearts so that we would get it. Not only on the inside, but on the outside. God, I just thank you for how all-encompassing your story is. God, I'm just reminded over and over again that we don't deserve. Just thinking about, even now, that you left your throne room. You didn't have to do that, but what a great love. What a great motivation. The joy set before you. And God, may that bother us. May we be so bothered by it that we want to rip the veil off and really see you for who you are, to see you in all of your glory. And God, may we just want to soak in that presence of who you are, finding your favor, knowing that it pleases you, to even come humbly and say, man, I am a mess. But God, you have looked beyond that through your son, and you can be in my presence if you just take the sacrifice of my son. Ah, we love you, Jesus. Thanks for throwing it out there and leaving it on the table for us to take and eat and know that you are good. In your son's name, amen.